Summertime and living is easy.
It's summer. Time to travel to a beautiful location, relax, and enjoy some music. Which apparently is what all of the classical musicians do, because we can't find any to do classical classroom episodes in town. So, we headed to the hills. And lo, we discovered there are these magical musical oases, called classical music festivals. Every summer, students, performers, and orchestras spend their supposed time off making yet more music. Each year, Classical Classroom is going to highlight a different festival. This year, we traveled to sunny Santa Barbara, California, to the Music Academy of the West. So chill out, hang ten, insert other surfer phrases, and enjoy this Classical Classroom Summer Music Festival series. Hey everybody, I'm Daisha Clay. Welcome to the fourth installment in our Summer Music Festival series, Music Academy of the West Edition. In this episode, you'll be hearing my chat with Cynthia Phelps, principal violist of the New York Philharmonic. She has done a short residency with the Music Academy this summer. But first, let's hear a brief overview of what this festival is from one of our series spirit guides, Music Academy of the West President and CEO Scott Reed.
So the Music Academy is an 8-week summer program. We go from June to the beginning of August, and we really cater to the world's greatest young musician. Average age is about 23. And we bring in 140 fellows. We call our students fellows because they're all on full scholarship at the Academy, which makes our program very competitive. And what we do is we recruit the most talented roster of faculty and guest artists to work with these fellows. So it's really the bringing together of the greatest young musicians with the greatest seasoned musicians. So they can work together, they can learn from one another, and we can really prepare these young musicians for sustainable, vibrant careers in music.
Thank you, Scott. Now on with the show. Today, as I mentioned, my guest is Cynthia Phelps. Cynthia is a New York Philharmonic principal violist. In addition to playing with orchestras nationally and internationally, she's also played with chamber orchestras like the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center and has toured with string quartets like the Brentano. She's a Grammy-nominated recording artist, and this summer she's been in residence at the Music Academy of the West. Cynthia Phelps, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you.
So to prepare for this interview, I studied up on viola and violist jokes.
Uh-oh.
And I know, this is a phenomenon I'm not sure that some of our listeners are aware of. Apparently, if you go online and you look up classical music memes of any sort, all of these incredibly cruel viola jokes come
up. It's true.
So
it's true.
I'll just give a quick sample of one of these jokes. So, Cynthia, how do you get two violists to play in tune with each other?
You know, I don't know that one. I don't pay attention to viola jokes, and I'm rather glad to hear that you're not sure it's a phenomenon that your listeners are familiar with, because that means they're dying out.
Well, the punchline is you ask one of the violists to leave. This is how you get them to play in tune with each other. So
yes.
Anyway, listeners, this is how we welcome guests to the Classical Classroom. We insult them from the outside.
Real pleasure to be here, Daisha.
Awesome. So as a violist and a viola expert, I have to ask you, why does everyone make fun of the viola? I've wondered this for a long time.
Well, the viola is an unusual size for an instrument that you hold under your chin. It's bigger than a violin. The intervals are bigger. The timbre is sort of in that middle range, so it doesn't really have the brilliance of a violin nor the depth of a cello. It's a true middle voice. And there have not been a lot of pioneers for the viola. Some of our heroes, of course, would be William Primrose, who was an international soloist around the 30s, 40s, 50s. I was very lucky to be able to study with him the last year that he was alive. Paul Hindemith, the composer, was a violist as well. But it's an instrument that's not been showcased as a solo instrument, in part because there hasn't been a lot of repertoire thrown our way.
Yeah.
So over the years, the lore is that if a violinist can't make it on the violin, they just switch to the viola because the repertoire simply is not as demanding as the violin repertoire. So there are a lot of violists around that get the bum rap of being kind of lazy and not good enough to be a violinist. And that's kind of where it came from.
I see. Okay, I see. So it's not your fault. It's just that it's an instrument for which not a lot has been composed, or at least not as much as the repertoire for violin.
Violin or cello, yeah. I mean, cello doesn't have a huge allotment of solo music either, but certainly more than violists do.
So we've done episodes of the show on just specific instruments, and I realized before we started talking today that we've never actually done one on the viola. Like, we've talked to violas, but we've never really talked about this instrument at all. So first, I'd love to just have an overview. Can you tell me about, I mean, you just kind of talked about what makes it unique as far as its voice and its size.
Yes.
Where did this instrument come from? Did it evolve from the same time and place as the violin and the cello? How did that
come
about?
No, I mean, it evolved from the viola da gamba as a Baroque instrument, which was held between the knees and bowed like a cello, held like a cello. It's interesting because the viola that I play on, which is owned by the New York Philharmonic, is a very early example of the evolved instrument to being held underneath the chin. It's a Gaspard de Salo. Mm. The date is somewhere between 1560 and 1580, so quite old. That's really when the first modern-day violas were crafted. Mm. And, you know, you can imagine, so a viola da gamba wasn't really a solo instrument either. I mean, it took part in Renaissance music and would somehow be a supportive line more than anything. And today's viola, well, still very much has the same role as a supportive line. We sit between the violin and the cello timbrely, and we often have the rhythmic structure left up to us, or some key harmonic changes will be our role to play. That is in the orchestral repertoire, often in the string quartet repertoire, which is our richest body of repertoire. So it's an ensemble instrument, much like the alto voice in a chorus.
Would it be accurate to say that the viola is sort of like the rhythm guitar in a rock band?
Not quite, but that's the interesting thing about the viola is that it often plays that role. It can play a variety of roles, and understanding that role, embracing it, and capitalizing on it is something that makes today's violas very successful. It's important that they are prepared to take any competition, take any audition, be in a string quartet, some kind of smaller ensemble, be able to stand up and play a recital, because it's an instrument that is so beautiful. I can't tell you how gratifying it is to play a recital and then have people come up and say, "The viol is such a beautiful instrument. I'd much rather go to a viol recital than a violin recital." And it has that capability. It's such a beautiful color. It has such depth and gorgeous, mellow, rich, velvety timbres that I think that it's often overlooked because you don't really notice it unless something goes bad, something goes wrong.
Well, I see. And this is why the jokes.
Yes.
Because, okay. Well, So before we go on, because you've been talking so much about the sound, I'd love to hear the sound. Is there a piece that we can listen to that is a good example?
Absolutely. I think that Berlioz's Herald in Italy, which was crafted as a viola concerto, would be a great introduction. It starts with a very slow, moving melodic figure, then develop. So if you would want to play the opening of Herald in Italy, when the viola comes in, I think that would give a good idea of the color of the instrument.
Okay. Here we go. Thank you. That's a perfectly lovely sound.
And thank you.
This is you playing with the New York Philharmonic.
Yes.
So what I'm noticing about this sound, though, just generally, is that it's got, I'm not sure what it is, but like it's definitely a deeper sound.
Yes.
But I hear...
It's deeper. I will say that as far as instruments, actual violas go, instruments, there's a huge range of color amongst us, the instruments, even more so than with cellos and violins, because the size varies quite a bit. Mm. And the smaller violas don't have quite the carrying power, or maybe even the overtones, depending on how fine an instrument it is. But there is a huge variation in what a viola sounds like. Often I'll hear a violist play and they'll sound almost like a cello, but not quite. That's the thing, it's that in-between instrument that, and I think it's got its own incredible beauty that people listen to and say, wait, that's not a cello and that's not a violin, but it sounds like both at different times.
Yeah. Well, what drew you to this instrument? I mean, you know, you've discussed how there's not a big body of work to choose from.
I'll tell you what drew me.
What was it?
I grew up in a family with four sisters, five girls, and we all play instruments. We're all professional musicians today, and I was the fourth. And I was given a violin, like my older sister, and there's already a cellist and a pianist. And I took up the violin, and I did not like that violin, but I kept practicing and playing. And my little sister came along, and she played the violin too. And I finally said, can I just play the cello instead? I like that sound better. And my mother said, why don't you try a viola, and we'll see how you do with that. And so I was given a viola when I was about 10. And she said, just keep playing the violin so you can sort of build up your muscle memory in your fingers and, you know, develop a technique. And the minute I had that viola and I had that C string instead of the E string, the E string is the highest string on the violin. The C string is the lowest string on the viola. And it is the exact same strings as a cello, but an octave higher. And I was so happy. I just loved the sound under my ear. You know, everyone's sense of sound comes from inside their head. And it was an instrument that I could really work with and develop the sound. And I went back to my junior high orchestra in the viola section this time. And the conductor looked at me and said, wow, have you been practicing all summer? Because it was really something that turned me on. I really loved the sound quality.
Yeah, you found your thing.
I did.
Yeah. You brought up the orchestra. I kind of have a sense of how many violins are in an orchestra. How many violas are in a typical orchestra?
There are six stands, 12, okay. 12 players.
Okay, got it. So we should hear some more music. Can you give us another example of a composer who's done good work for the
absolutely.
Viola?
Okay. You bet. Mozart actually played the viola.
Never heard of him.
And he wrote some of the most beautiful quintets are by Mozart, two viola quintets, really outstanding works. And he also wrote two duets for violin and viola. And you can get an idea of the difference between the two instruments if you play maybe part of his G major duet.
Okay. So talk a little bit about what's going on in this piece.
Well, as you can hear, it's a dialogue. And you can see that the viola does indeed play a supportive role, but You can hear also the tune. Here's the secondary melody coming. The violin will have it. Mm-hmm. And then the viola has it coming up right here. So when it's paired with the violin, it's being asked to have the bass and the rhythm and trade the melody back and forth. And that's what's going on in this piece.
So I feel like we're getting a little bit of a sense of the different roles that the viola can play. We've heard it.
Well, there
as...
it is. There it is in a little baby chamber setting. Now, a larger chamber would be something like the Glazunov String Quartet, for instance, which is for two violins, two cellos, and a viola. However, Glazunov, who was a big champion of all different instruments, he wrote a beautiful saxophone concerto. I mean, he wrote for many different instruments, partly because he was an alcoholic and was always running out of money, so he took whatever commissions he could get. I don't know who commissioned this viola, or cello quintet, but it's quite beautiful, and it starts out with a big viola solo in the very beginning. So you can see there that that initial first theme is introduced by the viola, the middle voice in this group where you have two violins and two cellos. And I thought it was very smart of Glazunov because he took the same melodic fragments, gave them to the cellos, they worked their way up to the fiddles, and then he's able to actually start developing that first theme before it then goes on to the second theme. So you can see the viola often plays a very pivotal role, really pivotal, in changing the harmonic development. Now here's the second theme, again in the viola. Now it goes to the violin, which increases the tension because it's a higher instrument.
It's kind of like an instrument that bridges transitions.
It can be used that way, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is, many people don't really know what the viola does. Violas themselves don't even realize the important role that they have. I think a violist in a string quartet would certainly know because that's a very, very singular role, very important role. But in an orchestra, sometimes you think, well, I'm just playing this rhythmic stuff, the offbeats or whatever. And actually, I mean, I tell my students all the time, when you were sitting there playing the offbeats, you have to be giving the tunes something to get their energy from, or you have to be able to underpin the crux of the phrasing. You know, you move with the phrases. And you know, often it can just be sort of grunt work if you don't love it, or if you don't love music, or if you're not just completely engaged in the music all the time. But if you are, the role becomes very interesting, very varied, and very rewarding.
You have to be very, it sounds like you have to be very adaptable. And
you have to be adaptable. I told you I was a 4 out of 5. Violists are often the peacemakers in any in any situation, and you have to deal with big egos. And, you know, it's a very supportive role, and when you do step out of that supportive role, you have to be completely excellent. It's not the easiest instrument, but I think that it's really come into its own, and I really hope many of your listening audience don't know viola jokes, because that would make me really happy.
Well, so speaking of like, you are the principal violist in the New York Philharmonic, and so you're essentially the leader of this instrument that often in orchestral pieces is providing support. So it's like you are a leader for people who are sometimes not leading the music. What is that
exactly
like? How is it to be in that role for you in this orchestra?
It's always different. You know, when one plays a piece of music, hopefully one is always engaged in everything that goes on. So if we're listening to the tune in the bassoon or in the first horn or accompanying a cello solo, you're always engaged. One is always engaged, aware of when they need to step out of what they're doing and have more of a profile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often not clear at all.
Yeah.
You know, you have to figure out what's going on in the music. Oh, this is important. I need to be able to be there for this person, or I need to take charge myself right now. And it's a path that's not easily negotiated and not always clear. I think for violas, more than any instrument, certainly more than any other string instrument, if you're playing a Haydn symphony, you know, it's really a lot of rhythmic underpinning.
Mm-hmm.
If you're playing a Beethoven symphony, there will be a point where there's a fugue, perhaps, and you have to really step up to the plate and add your voice when it's the appropriate time in a very strong way, and then completely back away when the next fugal entrance comes in, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like it sounds like you're sort of learning how to be present, provide this very important role, but also sort of keep in perspective that you are not a special snowflake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone's special. Everyone's a special snowflake.
Yeah.
At different times when it's appropriate.
Yeah.
It's in a large way. I mean, all music is pretty much boils down to being like chamber music because you always have to listen to everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And unless you're standing in front of the orchestra as a concerto soloist playing, you know, the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto or whatever, it's never just about you.
And
even then it's not. But a solo mentality is an animal of its own.
Well, let's talk in the time that we have left about your work at the Music Academy of the West. I know that you're doing a 3-week residency, and we've talked to Matthew O'Coin, who is also doing a residency there, but he was talking to us about that from a composer's perspective. What does a residency mean for a musician? How do you spend your time there?
Well, I work closely with the students, and I give master classes, and I perform on the chamber music series. So what I like about my role there is the ability to really connect with students in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm home in New York with my students at Juilliard, we have the whole year. We can talk about the recitals that they're planning, the kinds of chamber music groups they're in, all of that. This is a very condensed amount of time to make a difference to somebody that I may not see again.
Yeah.
And so my role as a teacher in these summer weeks is to identify problems that I see are keeping these students from reaching their best potential. And then I try and outline what they should focus on and what they need to take back to their teachers. At the same time, identifying repertoire that would be helpful for, or etudes that would be helpful to work on certain problem areas in their playing that's holding them back. So it's a challenge because it's so condensed, and I'm only here for those 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And in fact, this summer, I gave 22 lessons in about 8 days because that was all I had. But it was great. I got to meet with each student twice, sort of assess what needed to be done, what their work was over the next few weeks. And of course, I also teach with Richard O'Neill, who is there in the weeks that I'm not there, and Karen Dreyfus, two other very fine violists on the faculty. So we discuss each student and what their strengths and weaknesses are and what they need to work on. I have to say it was very gratifying this year to come back from different tours and performances that I was doing in between and see such growth in these kids. So, and part of my role too is to help choose the applicants. So it's really gratifying to be able to know that I had some faith in these 11 fellows and that indeed they really came through with some good hard work and much progress.
Well, and I should remind listeners that the fellow is what the Music Academy of the West calls their students because they're all there on fellowships. I'm curious, since you're there, you're a an expert in the viola, you're a professional in your field. I mean, you basically are performing with the most amazing orchestra in the nation, maybe the world, I don't know, but so you are going there and you're sort of preaching the gospel of the viola to these fellows. And how is that? Are you infusing them with new energy? Are you seeing them take that energy and sort of further the cause of this instrument? What are you seeing come out of that?
You know, it's really all about connecting with any individual student and figuring out who is this person and why are they in music? Mm-hmm. What do they want to do with this? The vehicle, of course, is the viola, but more than anything, it's the music. How do you connect? How does music work for you? How do you find yourself connected to this world? What do you want to do with it? What do you want to do with this instrument in this world? And it's sort of taking on the responsibility of, you know, this age group is just so special. They're still being formed. They're still trying to figure out where they fit into the world and where their role is. One of my students said to me, I said, how has your summer been going? And she said, I've gained a lot of confidence. I used to have issues with feeling significant. And that's changed this summer. Hmm. And hearing that is just an amazing thing to
hear.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Seeing these students, these fellows, become self-confident and feel that they really have something to offer is what we do as teachers. That's what you do.
Yeah.
So it's a great form. It's really, I had it when I was a student there. I had many, many opportunities, and it's just really a thrill to be able to be back and be on the other end.
So how do you get in this residency? Because I know that when I was talking to Matthew O'Coin, he was talking about how it was a time that he was able to utilize to create new work and to sort of sit with that work with, you know, people who are playing it and in a way that just kind of doing work on your own didn't allow him. So do you, as a viola teacher there, like, do you get any me time as a musician? Do you also get to spend some time developing your own, I don't know, like spending time with your instrument? How does that work for you?
Well, I think that teaching is a beautiful thing because you're constantly analyzing the way people play their instrument and what they bring to it musically. So I learn from my students as well, of course. But I'm also at the Academy not just to teach but to perform. And I fill up the rest of the weeks that I'm not there performing. So my me time is preparing for my own performances,
of
course. But it's always a challenge. If I'm giving a master class, I need to be familiar with what the students are playing. I can't just pick up my instrument and not demonstrate unless I'm prepared to do so and can show something that the students can hear. You know, I think teaching is always a combination of using your words, using your ears, but also demonstrating when one needs to, because people learn at different rates and in different ways, and you never know what's going to speak to your student. So it's important that I stay at the top of my game, and it affords me that opportunity and that challenge to be involved in that way.
So I have a couple more questions for you, and then I'm hoping that you can take us out on a piece of music. But I'd like to know, I'm sure that you have been to many music festivals, as I found that most of the classical musicians I've talked to have. What makes the Music Academy of the West experience unique to you among the other festivals?
It's the only festival in which I teach. The other festivals are simply all performance-based, unless there's a quartet that I might be coaching. But it's the only one where I actually have private pupils, so it's quite different.
Hmm.
And it's a wonderful faculty, so it's great to be able to perform with other teachers who have a performance career but also teach. Many of the festivals where I play right now are mainly performers. So it's just a little bit different in that way.
Yeah. And what are you doing for fun while you're there? This is one of my favorite questions about Music Academy of the West people is the variety of answers to this particular question.
Well, I'll tell you, and I have to say that I grew up out in Southern California. My mother lives about 20 minutes south of the academy. Uh-huh. So I have, as I mentioned before, a very big family. So it's always wonderful for me to be here because I'm very close to all of my sisters that are still here in Southern California. I'm very outdoors oriented. I like to swim in the ocean. I spent a long time running and playing tennis. I can't do either one of those sports anymore, but I fill it up with swimming and I just love to be outdoors. So this is really my home territory and it's a thrill to be back.
That's kind of great. You've got your peeps there. You've got the outdoors.
That sounds That's right.
Sounds like a really good time in addition to all of
the oceans
hard
and
work
the mountains.
Yeah. Well, can you take us out on a piece of music, another good example of the viola?
Absolutely. There's a beautiful viola solo in a piece by Vaughan Williams. A lot of beautiful, beautiful music was written from British composers. A lot of it was for William Primrose, who was Scottish, actually, but he did a lot of premieres of pieces that were written by British composers. This was not written for him, but it's a beautiful, beautiful melody. It's called A Theme and Variations on a Theme by Thomas Tallis, and the viola gets the actual theme.
Cool.
And again, preparing for the violin entrance. So the viola gets it first, and mm-hmm. then the composer will build tension or change the color or change the mood by having the violin then take the melodic fragment.
It's like the viola has warmed up the crowd.
Exactly.
And then, yeah.
And now they're in duet, as you can see.
Yeah.
Also, there's another piece of music you might want to play which shows the viola in a very different light. It's a solo piece. It's one I include a lot on my recitals.
Oh, yeah.
I've recorded it. It's a piece by George Enescu, the Romanian composer. It's called Concert Piece.
Okay.
And it gives sort of the idea of the virtuosity of the viola as well.
Nice.
It's just the mellow.
Lovely.
It is. It heats up.
Oh, it heats up. Oh, here
it
we
does.
Go. That's great. That's a really different example of what
Very
the instrument
example.
Can do.
And well, if you don't mind, I just would love to say one more thing.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Because we have so little repertoire. I've been very, very lucky in that the New York Philharmonic commissioned a composer for me to write a viola concerto, which I'll be premiering in November with the New York Philharmonic. A young woman named Julia Adolph. She's a doctoral student at the University of Southern California. And the piece is terrific. I gave a warm-up debut of it with the Eastern Music Festival. Jerry Schwartz was conducting just a couple of weeks ago. And it's a terrific piece, so I'm very thrilled to have a vehicle that I can pass on to, you know, the next generation of violists. It's really thrilling.
Wow,
so
that's super cool.
I'm quite happy about that.
Very cool. Well, we look forward to hearing that. And Cynthia, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show today.
Of course.
This has been awesome. I appreciate you teaching me about this instrument that I'd only kind of heard about before.
Well, now you know.
Now I know. And now I know what the
jokes
are about. No more jokes, people. Thanks, Cynthia Phelps. It has been awesome to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right, everyone. That's it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Find our social media links there. Pick your poison. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to us, rate us, review us on iTunes, because every time you do, an angel gets its wings. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Tubit Hulslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing ponyboy Curtis eyes. Thanks to Catherine Barnes over at KCRW for her help with this episode. She's definitely a greaser, not a soge. Thanks to Cynthia Phelps for being here today. Stay gold, Cynthia. Thanks to the good people at the Music Academy of the West, especially to Kate Obriott, who we appreciate a lot. Thanks also to Cynthia's manager, Elizabeth Dworkin, and to Pamela Walsh at the New York Philharmonic for their help with this episode. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.